Hello and welcome to episode 184. God, this is getting too much. This is getting too high. What are we going to do when we get to 3,562?
We just reset and start one again. When we get to 200, let's just go back to one. Should we just do that?
Yeah, we might need to. Of the Adoption Fostering Podcast with me, Scott Castanrennie, himself, Al. Oh, sorry, Al. I was going to give you a name. Sorry, guess.
I think the cat is literally out of the bag.
Yeah.
This is podcast gold. I think
it's lovely. Yeah.
I think, you know, after all these years, who are you? Al Coates, social worker, yes. debonair extraordinaire.
And tonight we are joined by I think she's a very special guest because I haven't seen her for so long, and I used to work with her. Many moons ago, well, not many moons ago actually, but it was at least 5 years ago, because that's when I left Adoption UK, and this lady worked for PAC UK. So welcome to Jenny Ginger, and that is her real name before anybody writes to us or asks us or whatever you say. So welcome, Jenny, and it is so lovely to have you on at long last.
Thank you very much, and it's really nice to be here. And it is probably 5 years, Scott, since we worked together. And yeah, you were in Adoption UK, and I was in Adoption UK, and then I was in PAC UK, and then I wasn't anywhere for a bit because I left to do this piece of research. So really nice to be with you guys.
Well, I met Jenny last week at the Coram Bath conference. She introduced herself. She went, "Hello, I'm Jenny Ginger." And up until then, I thought she was a figment of your imagination, Scott. dear listener, we get different people come on through different routes, and this was sort of one of your routes, wasn't it? And I thought, oh, it's Scott just pretending he's got friends. But it turns out you're real, Jenny, and it was lovely to meet you and to have this podcast. It's really good.
Thank you very much. It was really nice to be at the conference the other day. And as I said at the time, I think you spoke very passionately about adoption support and a great advocate for that. In a room
for
social workers, which is a really, really good thing to do.
See, I don't get invited to things like that anymore, Jenny, because I don't live in the UK. And I'd say every week or every other week on the podcast, because I live in Ireland, people think that it's like hundreds and thousands of miles away when it's not.
A different country.
Yeah, well, it is a different country, but I'm still local. You know, it's literally a 20 quid flight and I'm there. So, but anyway, that's a side thing.
You're starting to sound bitter.
I know, I am a little bit. Okay, Sir Al. So anyway, so tonight, so Jenny, you go on.
News item. Can I just do a news item at the beginning? Sorry, just really boring. Two news items. One is, I think I mentioned it in our last podcast that Julie Selwyn had got me in an intellectual headlock at this said event. She also said, would I please push out the piece of research that she's doing? Uh-huh. And so I've got much more details now. It's called Family Roots, and I thought it was called Family Roots. And I think it's a plain, as in R, it's roots, R-O-U-T-S, as opposed to R-O-O-T-S. So it's Family Roots, O-U, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a research project about growing up in an adoptive or special guardianship family. I will put the bump in the show notes. I think anything that Judy Selwyn is doing is really worth getting on board with. All of her work is usually pretty well kind of read and established. And so it's for people, it's an online survey for adults with adoptive parents, special guardians who have children aged 12 to 25. And for also they're doing that with young people as well, aged 12 to 25. So on an adoption or special guardianship order, it's finding out about roots out of home life and early adulthood and all of that kind of stuff. So I will put the link in there. And the second item is, please go to our Facebook.
I shall even have a look at that.
Will you? But you're from an island, you might not be eligible, Scott.
I can.
What?
I believe both my children were adopted in the UK. One still lives there, and he's certainly within that age range as well. You know,
so. Perfect, perfect. And the other thing is, please go to our Facebook page before we get into anything else today. If you join our Facebook page, because it's been a hoot today, hasn't it? In relation to this subject matter that we're going to talk about today. So join our Facebook. Join up. We've got a Facebook group that we don't do very much on, but when we do, we boy do we do it. So just that was it, linking to our Facebook page, which will be referenced later. Now I'm going to shut up and I'm going to run this show because it's your guest.
Anyway, so Jenny, you dropped a message we were talking earlier, and it has been a couple of years since we've been in touch. And I think actually the last time we were in touch was when Jan Slater sadly passed away from PAC UK and from many other places, it has to be said, Adoption UK, a number of county councils and stuff. And I think we actually talked about it on the podcast when she did, because she was previously my manager as well. I know she was your manager, but that was really the last time we talked. But I know when we last talked that you were embarking on this new, I don't know what you'd call it, this new project, because you were in the process of leaving PAC UK and going into a totally different kind of dimension, I guess. So what have you been up to, Jenny Ginger? And give us a bit of an intro to yourself.
Okay, so Jenny Ginger, I'm an adoptive parent. I'm an adoptive parent of two girls, but I'm not an adoptive parent of a biologically related child. And that's an important part to put in here straight away. But yes, so I was head of service for a while at PAC. And we were giving peer support, really, for families that were struggling, families in crisis, referred by social workers across the UK, but not Ireland, Scott.
No, that wouldn't be the case.
And those families, about 70% of the 200 referrals that we had in the time that I was running that service, about 70% of those families were parents who had a biological child. And that became interesting to me because I wanted to know more about what we knew about what adoption was like in families where they had a biological child and an adopted child. And the more I asked social workers or academics about this, it was clear that people didn't really know very much about it at all.
Yeah.
So it was very much a gap in the research, but that, you know, that sounds a very sort of academic thing to say, and that's not really my point. My point is that I wanted to find out more so that I could feed back to social workers and agencies about how maybe they could look at their policy and practice in regards to these families. So I had to find out more about the families, and I had to find out more about what social workers did when they worked with these families to prepare them, to assess them, and to support them. And it's become a PhD thesis, which was not my intention, actually. I remember I talked to Julie while I was still at PAC about this, and I said, well, it'd be a really interesting piece of research to do. And she said, oh, the best way to do it is a PhD, because you get a lot more support that way. I don't know whether she was putting her hand up at that point, but she got lumbered.
Well, she is in the know, let's be honest. She knows her stuff, doesn't she, Julie? So, you know.
Quite strong in places. And so, I launched off into this. COVID accompanied me through this journey,
Which
made it a little bit complicated because the interviews that I did with parents, about 22 parents, they were all had to be done on Teams or Zoom, which people were just about getting used to doing that. And, I feel really humbled, actually, by people's willingness to share their stories with me and to trust me and over that kind of medium, because it's not easy to do that. And then sort of click and you're off, and it's not like you can sit and have a cup of tea after you've had an interview. And the same thing with the social workers, although we got towards the end of COVID and I was able to run some focus groups. That was really good. The research is the views of parents and of social workers about experiences of adoptive family life with a birth child and how preparation and assessment for that, how that works and how support works. So a lot of things, and probably too many things, maybe.
Can I ask, because I'm really intrigued by the idea that actually, why is there a gap in the research? And is that because this is a growing phenomena, because people's journeys to adoption are different now, or is Or is it just something we've never seen, or is it and it's always happened? What were your kind of ponderings on that?
Yeah, it has always happened. And the interesting thing is that there is no requirement to keep any data about the structure of families that adopt. So although there's data about local authorities and agencies have to submit data to the DfE, I believe it is, about the number of children that are adopted and whether they're adopted by same-sex couples or single people or married couples. But there is nothing in there that says about the presence of any other children in that family. So there's no data about it. So that's one thing. And that means that we don't really know what percentage of adoptions are in families where there is a birth child. And I think there's been, I have to be careful how I say it, but I think there's been a little bit of a bundling in of everybody together. And that, you know, one of my hypotheses was it's one size fits all process. Mm-hmm. And that for these families, there are areas, there are gaps for them. And I think that's why there are gaps in research, because there isn't the data. We don't know how many families there are. It gets mentioned, you know, they get mentioned in other bits of research, like, you know, inter-sibling relationships. And, you know, there might be reference to families where there's a birth child in those. But in terms of actual focused research on adoptive families where somebody's had a birth child and then adopted, there is very little.
Yeah. And it seems like that's quite a reasonable thing to be able to report on. I mean, it's not like you're, I mean, my dealings with the DfE and the when it was a thing was what was it called again, that
I don't know, but it's a great phrase. My dealings with the DfE.
Yeah,
well, my dealings, you know, with the
in my day. But I remember because I sat with one of the regional ALBs in Cambridgeshire when I lived there. And each month or each meeting that we had, I think they were quarterly, they would present the kind of the numbers and stuff. And I was always taken aback by how much data they didn't have. And this seems like something quite simple that they could have, you know, because it's not asking too much, is it? You know, if you're going to place children outside of their natural family, then surely, you know, we should be recording exactly where they go, what the families. Yeah, I know, but I think that we're into a new phase of adoption now where, you know, things are very different. And I think that this is quite relevant stuff, really, for the future. If, you know, if adoption is to kind of still be here in 20 years, just putting that out there.
Yeah, I think it's also important, Scott, because it can help agencies decide how they're going to resource their support, the preparation. You know, those factors, if you don't know what percentage of families have a birth child and they do have additional requirements, then how do you know how to resource that?
I mean, I know what the answer would be. I know that they would say that they don't want to overwhelm the organizations with data collection because the data set itself is massive. And I do the fostering data set, and it's a massive task, and I'm a small agency. But interestingly, and this is something I forgot to say from the back off the back of the post-adoption support conference last week, is that Adoption England are going to start collecting data in terms of post-adoption. And I just wonder whether that is part of something that we would consider valuable enough. Anyway, I don't know how to answer the questions that Scott's asking. I'm going to shut up.
No, you're fine, because obviously you have more sensible questions than I do sometimes. I just find that part of it quite strange. I know what you're saying, Al, but actually it's a very simple thing to be able to add to a submission for numbers.
I think as well, if I can just jump back in there.
Please do.
You're our guest.
Yeah, you're our guest. If we could just rattle on about this subject, you know, you've got to break in, you've got to push through.
I thought you told me it was going to be all about me, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. And Al just pipes up. So, you know, I was letting you talk, see? You know,
I'm shutting up. Fingers on lips.
What I was going to say was the number of social workers and agencies who've asked me if I have an idea of what the numbers are. And I think that's interesting because they do want to know. And it's one of those things that becomes obvious once somebody's pointed out to you, and you probably knew it already, but it just hadn't really materialized as an action. So that's what I think about that.
Okay. Interesting. And we got a sneaky peek of your presentation. And what struck me from that, not going into the details of it, because that's up to you, what you can share and what you can't share, because I can't do it. But what struck me is that as somebody who adopted again with adopted children in the house, and looking at some of the questions and also some of the comments that we've had from the Facebook page as well, I'm really interested to hear about the preparation and all that kind of stuff for birth children home, because I know that my, you know, as an adoptive parent who fostered and then adopted that foster child, I don't know if that's the right word to use these days. I mean, I'm not sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. I'm intrigued to know the kind of preparation process and stuff like that. So what kind of stuff did you stumble upon that actually made you go, all of it, probably.
Before I answer that, I just wanted to say a couple of things about how I answer these questions. So this was not a comparative study. So I wasn't looking at adoption in families with biological children and adoption in families without. So I'm not looking at is better or those kinds of factors. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of things that still need exploring and explaining. And this feels like it's kind of the tip of the iceberg, really, because there was so little known. Mm. And as I said before, people had different experiences and different views of that experience. Mm-hmm. I think the preparation of the birth child is an area of challenge for everybody. And social workers would try to prepare the birth child, and parents would try to prepare the birth child. But I think the conclusion that a lot of people were coming to, or have come to, but will still work with it, is that it's really hard to prepare a child for what is going to happen to their family. Mm-hmm. And if you've grown up, you've been born into a family, and you've grown up, or not grown up, but you've grown with your parents, and you've been the only child there, not always, because some of the families in the study had more than one birth child. Mm. Then if somebody has a subsequent child from a pregnancy, there's a sort of preparation that comes naturally with pregnancies. Mm. Somebody say, I'm going to have a baby, and bump, and you buy things. So adoption, as we know, happens very, very differently. And it varies according to the age and stage, I think, from what I've seen, the age and stage of the child, how much they can understand, cognitively grasp what is going to happen to them, and then actually process the emotional impact of that in advance. I think it's hard for us as adoptive parents to do all of that beforehand. Yeah. So for a child, people try, they try, you know, really from a position of intent, good intent. But a small young child, it's really hard to prepare them. Mm. And I know some parents have talked about, it was really, really good. And we had some, you know, very supportive social workers who worked closely with us. But the ability of a child to understand what is going to happen next, maybe they can, but to maintain and sustain that right the way through what happens next, and the challenges that we know that may come with the child being placed, and how that plays out over the next few years, seems to vary, but it wasn't something I specifically was looking at, but it seems to vary with the older children finding that more easy to cope with than a younger child. Have I kind of answered your question, Scott? I feel like
I think so. Yeah. I mean, go on now. Sorry.
No, I was going to say the more I hadn't really thought about that in terms of what the assessment process would look like for a child, and what would, you know, if you think about it, I'm putting my sort of child specs on and thinking, mum and dad or dad and dad, you know, whatever, go off to a, go off to a, go off, thank you, yes. They go off to, what it is, LGBTQI month.
I'm not sure, well, I mean, same-sex parents probably wouldn't have, they might, yes, but not together, not
don't,
together.
Don't bring your prejudice and stereotype to this podcast.
That can happen, I hate to tell you. Two men cannot have a birth child between them, just saying,
they
all right.
Could, well, and yeah, I get that, but what I'm saying is there could be a child as part of that household that, that could from be from a different relationship, yeah, or a different, yeah, constitution.
I'm only arguing for the sake of an argument.
I know, but my thought is that I'm trying to imagine if a child, if you spoke to a child and said, what was your experience of the process, they would, what would they actually be able to articulate, and what was their involvement other than perhaps a couple of meetings with a social worker who was talking to their parents or parent? And I just thought, that's really interesting, actually, because is that a, if there is a higher prevalence, and some of your statistics there where you said that 70% of the inquiries,
70% of the referrals for support, yeah, but I don't think there are 70% of the families that adopt have a birth child for support. I think it's probably nearer, it's between somewhere between about 10 and 30%. I mean, that really is a kind of ballpark figure, but it's not as high as 70%, I don't think, but still, you know, 10-30%,
it's a significant, it's a lot. Yeah, if it's 30, it's a third of all families come with a child. And so you'd have thought there would be a higher, or there'd be a better kind of, the process would be able to accommodate that and manage that and support that. Mm-hmm. Are there any agencies doing something that we wouldn't be expecting? Is there anything bespoke for children, or is it just to sit down with a social worker?
They do, some social workers do work directly with the birth child. And in fact, I'm sure they all do to an extent, but it, you know, what can you do? You can talk to a child and you can say, how do you feel about this happening? And they'll go, oh, I'm really excited because I want a brother sister. maybe some children will say, actually, I don't want this. And even then, there'll be a conversation that goes on to, well, you know, all children say that, don't they, when they're going to get a sibling, that they don't really want them. You know, those kinds of dialogues that happen. And I'm not saying that's what social workers are saying in this situation necessarily, but how can you tell that a birth child has been well prepared? I mean, what is it you're looking for? What is, you know, they're children, and they can't encapsulate in their minds or envisage what this big change is going to be, and it is a big change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know you said that this study is not comparative to anything else, but I'm just thinking back to my experience, and maybe yours as well, but you know, you had three children and then you went to foster and then adopt as well, and I'm just thinking about that whole process. And like I say, I know it's not comparative, and I know there's going to be a massive amount of differences. When I think about the preparation from the social worker from my children when we became foster carers, and then actually there was nothing from that fostering aspect to the adoption. It was just about fostering. You're right. It is literally, for the most part, just a chat. And how can anybody know what to expect until that child is living with you and taking over, because the likelihood is they're younger than the children that are already with you, whether it's birth or adopted anyway. And I don't know if that would be your experience, Al, but certainly for me, I'm just kind of thinking back all those years ago.
Back in the day, no, that's exactly the same for us. And it made me think about what preparation my children were given other than us talking to them. Yeah. And yeah, how robust is that assessment?
Yeah.
Sorry, I interrupted. I think what is interesting is to not think about the preparation of a child, but the ongoing preparing of them right the way through the whole process and beyond. You know, it's not like it's a child who's part of the assessment process where parents are assessed and then they go to panel and they're through and that's it. And the child is part of that. It needs to be more than that. It needs to be sort of, it runs right the way through and beyond in terms of the work that social workers do. And they would like to do that. They would really like to do that.
Mm.
They recognize that.
Yeah, and of course, this is sort of, you know, this is on reflection as well, isn't it? You know, people are actually, they've built the family and they're living with it, and I'm thinking about the excitement of going through, and you know, all three of us adoptive parents, we know we went through that stage where we were like, oh wow, we're going to be parents and blah blah. So there's I'm suspecting there might be an element of excitement from the prospective parents in terms of having another child in the family and them having that excitement and the child kind of going along with that, not realizing just the impact that's going to make. So in terms of you know, how you can prepare a child for what's going to come, that must be even harder for the parents. And I know, you know, I'm not sure if that was anything that came up in your research, Jenny, but you know, I'm just thinking that would be very difficult for a child to kind of comprehend the potential negative aspect of, you know, the impact that another child coming into the family would have, whether it's, you know, birth child, adopted child, foster child, because of the excitement of the adults, maybe.
Yeah. So one thing that might be useful to think about in this area, and it didn't form a large part of the research, but early permanence can be maybe a useful approach for some of these families where it's a much younger child than the biological child, the birth child, but also the narrative is different. So you're not saying to the child, oh, you're going to have a baby brother or sister, but the story is, well, we're going to look after this child for a while, and whatever the story around that you can share that's age appropriate. And then there's obviously the risk that child will eventually or might end up going back to its birth family or somewhere else if it's early permanence. And that can have quite an impact on the parents. It can have an impact on the birth child, but possibly less so than it might have on the parents. There were some parents that I spoke to who said they'd thought about early permanence, but decided not to go down that route because they felt their child could cope, but they felt that they couldn't because of their own experience of loss and grief, that having a child brought into their life and then having that child removed again from them would just be too painful, and that pain and grief would then impact their birth child.
Can I just draw out some of the comments, because actually we've touched on quite a few of them, and I think on the Facebook page we had a really good natter about this. So I'll go back a little to the earlier question. We had a social worker who was asking how much their biological child was included in the assessment, which reflects what you said. But then that was picked up by a few people. Becky Brooks, friend of the show, asked a similar question. But in terms of how much children were included in planning for introductions and transitions, Caroline Shergold, who was on recently, and she's an adult adoptee and an adopter, she talked about having to actually push hard to get her children included in the assessment, which I thought was quite surprising. So did you have any sort of comments in terms of children being included in introductions and transitions other than in any sort of a, you know, perfunctory way?
Yeah, I think it varied a lot across the sample of parents. Sorry to refer to them as a sample, but some families had a really good experience of their birth child being included as much as possible from the start, right the way through to introductions where the child would be, particularly if people were having introductions with a child that was out of their area, that can be quite complicated if you've got an existing child. So things like that would happen during half term, so that the birth child could be involved rather than it happening in term time. So making those kinds of considerations. The other thing that varied though was some parents would say, we didn't really want our child involved to know what was going on, just in case we didn't get through the assessment process.
Well, okay. Of course, yeah.
get to panel. And I mean, you know, the three of us can understand that it all feels a bit precarious and you feel very vulnerable. Yeah. And you're trying your hardest to deliver what needs to be delivered in order to be approved. But if you've brought a child along through that process and said, oh, you know, this is what we're planning and isn't this exciting and this is how it's going to be. And then for some reason, it doesn't, some parents didn't want their birth child to really know much. Yeah. Until much later on in the process.
Mm. Wow. I didn't think of that, actually, because you would, in my little simple brain, you're thinking, well, you know, they're already a biological family and, you know, there's probably very few issues that they've got and stuff like that. And to be able to say, well, you know, we're going to try this process. I'm using words that we wouldn't normally use, but I'm going to try this process to see if we, you know, can help or whatever their motivation is. And I guess in my head, I'm just thinking, you know, you would think that for a child who's biological, that they would be quite comfortable to share that process and that journey with them. And, you know, I get that, you know, sometimes there could be an element of kind of disappointment or failure in some of these cases, but I guess in my head, I was just thinking, well, you know, you would take your family, it would be a family thing rather than just a couple things. So that's really quite an eye opener, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I think as well, the way that the birth child is present in the process is really interesting. And that sounds kind of transactional, but I've used those terms deliberately because when parents are coming into the assessment process and we're asked about evidence of capacity to parent a child and then looking at the capacity of parent and child from care. Mm. What there's quite a variety of views held by social workers about whether adoption in a family with birth child is a positive or not positive thing. So viewed positively through a lot of assessments because that birth child is evidence of capacity to parent. So it's a really helpful thing. It provides evidence for the PAR and it gets referred to in panel often about how that parenting experience is really useful. And then you get into sort of matching and introductions and there starts to be quite a lot of confusion for some families about how that experience is viewed and how having a birth child might not be such a positive thing because for some families they felt they waited longer to be matched than people who were childless. It's not clear how people would necessarily know, but you kind of get that feeling that maybe you've waited longer than people, maybe, you know, people from your prep groups or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then there were some social workers who would say to parents, or we don't place children in families where there's a birth child. Mm. That's pretty shocking, really, because you're not really allowed to say that kind of thing. You're not really meant to be thinking it either. But and that was very upsetting for some of those parents. Mm. So the position of the birth child, how the birth child is viewed, shifts. I feel that they're in a really shifting position that continues. It starts at the beginning in assessment as here is this child of great evidence parenting. We get into matching or how does this work? And maybe people wait longer because they're looking at age, you know, social workers look at age differences and, you know, age and I talk about age and stage, like developmental stage. And then you get into introductions, as you've mentioned, about how does that get managed? Right. And then you get into a child being placed and support. And that birth child's position shifts around a lot from the beginning right the way through. And not in every family, people settle in and sort themselves out and can be very happy. And, you know, as it said on your Facebook page, you know, some people have had a really good experience. Mm. But the thing that I feel is missing from this research, and I mean, I could talk about it for a long time, as I'm sure you can tell.
Well, it's your life's work at this stage in the game, isn't it? Come on, be fair on yourself.
Well, I mean, I was thinking about it, and I feel like we we can't even scratch the surface, because actually there's so much, you could go down so many avenues and routes and think about the implications for families. And it already, I'm scratching my head going, right. So Jenny, are you going to do a best practice guide?
There would be no better person.
Oh, bless you guys. Thank you. Yes, I think I probably am.
Yay!
I would really like to, but thank you. Oh, vote of confidence. Wonderful. The thing that keeps me awake at night, and it really does, is that we have the views of the adults in this and not the views of the young people.
Yeah.
And obviously I can't talk to children who are currently in adopted families and say, are you happy being in a family with your biological sibling? That would be very, very difficult to do and unethical, I think. But I am really, really interested in what I believe is the second half of this, which is getting the views of the young people, the adopted child who will now be an adult, the birth child now is an adult. Mm-hmm. Find out, what was it like? What is it like to be in a family? What do you remember of the process? What do you remember of the different things that happen? Has it been good for you? Because there is an impact on the birth child, very definitely. And for some children, it's fine. For a lot of children, it's quite tough. And I think for the parents of those children, they talk about their feelings of guilt, on how the adoption has impacted their birth child. I would really like to know how this experience is for these children. And I'd kind of feel a bit nervous about writing anything until I knew that, because I feel like I need to know a lot more.
Mm. if you were to believe the stories I read, certainly online, in terms of social media and stuff, and where perhaps someone's been adopted by a family with a child, you know, there appears to be, from the adopted child's perspective, a very big gap in terms of however, that could maybe not be completely true. But also, I guess in some ways, as somebody who's been adopted, which I'm not, you're not, Al's not, we will never know how that feels to be kind of put into a family that's you know, biologically and blood related, I guess. So that would be, you know, I think, you need to roll your sleeves up for that one, I think. Jenny?
I've just not been busy enough, clearly. Julie's research had highlighted elements of that, where there were phrases like one parent referring to their adopted child being eaten up by the presence of the birth child. And I know from my own children, who I hope won't be listening to this, but anyway, that issue about family resemblance is really key. And I'm sure a day doesn't go by, well, they've told me a day doesn't go by when they don't think about something to do with that kind of thing. Maybe they're thankful they didn't look like me. That could be. They could be looking at her and going, oh God, thank God we don't look like her. That's difficult enough if you don't look like your adoptive child. But to have a parent or two parents with a child that is biologically related to them and therefore has some elements of resemblance is a further kind of reminder, I think. I don't know. I'm just speculating, but.
Well, it's really tricky, because you could hypothesize that, and then, if especially children who experienced early separation, trauma, loss, that they're on the back foot before they get out of bed in the morning. And that was a technical term, wasn't it? And to put them in a household where there's a potential a comparison, that any sense of deficit in them anyway is going to be just exacerbated by having another child in the house. You could argue that, but then you could also argue that actually the sibling relationships can be incredibly positive. And you think, oh, matching is just... Wow, matching is like, I mean, it's an art form anyway, but this is high art, this.
It is really complicated, and for some families, having when a child, an adopted child or a child being adopted joins the family, if there's a child already there that's a birth child in this case, who's got a good relationship with their parents, and that child can come in and see a positive relationship between adults and a child, and that can be reassuring for some children who have only experienced difficult relationships with adults. And you know, I know there's some wonderful stuff that goes on in fostering, so that gives them another, you know, blueprint to go by. But to move into a family where there is an existing child who seems to feel comfortable and safe with the adults or adult can be helpful. So, you know, it can work. Do you see what I mean? It's just like I've pulled a piece of string and there's so many threads that, you know, where do I go?
Well, I mean, that is very true. And I was going to say, because reading the presentation you sent us, which I'm not going to share any of, I know that it's not, you know, it's not available yet, but I'm sure it will be at some point. There just seems so many comparisons to the experiences that I've heard over the last 10, 15 years from kind of parents who've been through this process, whether they've got a child previously or not, or whether they've adopted it and then obviously had a birth child, let's say, or whatever. There seems to be a lot of similarities in terms of, you know, support as an example, or lack of support in terms of, you know, being able to help birth children, you know, because let's be honest, you know, some of the experiences that these birth children are going to have isn't going to be anything that they're used to. And if we can't help the adopted child, how are we supposed to help the birth child?
Yeah, and the birth child gets forgotten not by the parents at all, but by the system. The system forgets them. Social workers, again, try to do what they can. But as you say, I mean, I think as you said, Al, last week, about a story about somebody being on a waiting list to have a social worker for adoption support. So if you're asking for support, you need somebody to help you. And you don't need to be on a waiting list. So if that's like that for an adopted child, then for the birth child who doesn't qualify for anything under the Adoption Support Fund, which is another area.
Yes.
So, you know, when we look at families, and, you know, I'm going to sound a bit political here, but, you know, the government takes children away from families and makes a decision about that and then decides where they're going to go next. The whole family adopts a child. It's not just the parents. And we need to be looking at families in adoption as whole families rather than just the parents, or a parent adopts a child and the birth child just happens to be there.
Yeah.
And it's really made me consider, like you said, the more you think about this, the more sort of different strands come off it. And I was thinking one of the issues that I obviously, it's kind of where I inhabit, is around when behavior becomes difficult and challenging. And often there's this dance around challenging behavior or behavior that challenges. And I thought that actually that for parents to see their other child or their biological child impacted by behavior, and that's not that uncommon for children to not play nice, that's a euphemism, is that a flashpoint that is kind of almost too much to bear for some parents? Did people sort of express that, you know, or give any windows into what was going on?
Yes, so that would go from a level of either just again, not everybody, there was some happy stories here as well, I have to just, you know, reinforce that. So for some families, there would be just the fact that the adopted child just sort of sucks out all the resources and just needs that parent 24/7 and, you know, all the other things that come with that, which is a deficit for the birth child. So there's a loss there in those situations. Mm. And I think that, you know, I think what runs through this is, is something about loss, actually, for, and I'm just trying to remember what you asked me, Al, which is
it's about when the impact on when how parents responded when other when their children, their biological children, maybe were physically hurt or just not doing very well, I guess.
That's it. Well done. Right.
Thank you. Thank you.
That is what you asked me. So I was saying, from that sort of level of just, you know, a lot of demand on parental time, to the sort of far extreme, which would be the adopted child doing something to the birth child, that can be not just once, but over a period of time. Mm-hmm. That can be a line that is crossed that can lead to, you know, disruption. A lot of difficulty. And I think the problem in the conflicting views of social workers about whether adoption in a family with a birth child is a positive thing or not, I think it's those that have worked in post-adoption who have worked with families in these situations and kind of have sort of war stories almost. And that sounds like a glib term, but it isn't. They you can, when they talk about it, they are kind of, they really felt the situation that the family is in, and they've seen sort of this birth child being, you know, the target of something, but they've also looked at this adopted child who is really struggling, and then suddenly it's like, well, they're just going to have to go because this isn't going to work, and that is really terrible for everybody, obviously. Really, really difficult.
Absolutely, yeah. And I'm just looking at the table of the families that you spoke, as in the setup of the families, not names or anything like that. What I'm saying. So there's 21 families in here, and what struck me was the kind of setup of some of them, because, you know, you'd think, oh, birth child and then adopted child, but you actually spoke to 6 families who had birth children, maybe 1, maybe 2, maybe 3, blah blah blah. And then the adopted child or adopted children. So it's not just a birth child, adopted child. There's quite a mix in your research, actually.
And just to reassure anybody who was involved in the research, there is absolutely nothing identifying.
No, there's no names.
There's no names. There's not even people's ages, because so the way I've done that is I've just said what key stage they were in terms of the educational key stages, rather than actually said anything about people's ages, just to make absolutely sure that people couldn't be identified. Yes, there were some families where their children were quite a lot older, and they decided that for some families it was a faith reason. For some families, it was an altruistic reason. For some families, it was they said, well, we always wanted to adopt, and you know, this just seemed to be the right time to do that. So it was, as you say, it's not just one birth child and one adopted child. Families.
It just struck me as that, you know, I don't know what you think when you're, well, I don't know what I was thinking when I, you know, when I was reading it, but it just struck me that, you know, it's not just one birth child and then they've adopted. There's a good mix in there. So,
because I see on, I'm part of different Facebook groups and forums, and see that the question that's often asked is people saying, "Oh, I've got a biological child, can I adopt?" And that is often, so they've got a 7-year-old and they've struggled with infertility and are wanting to adopt. But you sort of are hinting at this different sort of family that's got this, that's not coming from that drive of infertility, which is a different kind of family that brings a different set of nibbles to the buffet. In terms of, you know, sorry, Scott, you're looking at
what
me.
What a way to say it, for goodness sake.
Well, they do, but that's a nibbles but that, to that the motive, buffet. But that no motivation, it's intrinsically impacts. That might be a motivation that's shared by the whole family. That it's, you've got a 13-year-old who goes, no, I'm on board with this. This is an expression of their faith, our family's faith, or our family values, that we want to help a child who is less fortunate.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Al. And I think the thing is that the the majority of people were motivated by infertility. So they tried to have a subsequent child and they hadn't been able to. So, you know, there were feelings of loss and grief. And but the thing that they would talk about, because one of my first questions to parents was, tell me about what your life was like before you started your adoption journey.
Now, that's a question.
Yeah.
Can you remember what your life was like?
Hang on. Just going to
memories. Memories.
6'3", blonde.
No, that's going back too far.
That's way too far. Way too far.
I was going to say 6 foot. Whatever.
And they would talk about, oh, we were a happy family and we used to go and do stuff and we'd go away at the weekend and we'd ride bikes everywhere. And they would talk about feeling happy and that their child was happy and that, well, we didn't really have much challenge with our child. Although for some families, they'd had quite a lot of really big things happen. Like some of the adults had been unwell before they'd adopted, you know, there'd been bereavements of other family members. So it wasn't that everybody in the study said, oh, we're coming to this and we've all been absolutely happy. But the thing is that for some of those families, when they would talk about where they are now, there would be a sense of loss of that happiness and loss of what they were as a family. And I think the difference maybe is that when you are childless, as I was, then you adopt and you become a family. Mm. And for many of these, for all of these people in this study, they were a family already. And then something has changed in that family and they were hoping for something good. And for some families, it is great. And then for others, there's a sense of that their expectations have, their experience has not matched their expectations.
Well, that's really interesting because, yeah, I was thinking about, as you were talking, I was thinking about our experiences that we joined, we adopted three children and there was three adults because we have a friend who lives with it who's disabled and that's a long story. So we had three adults joined by three children, which immediately created this really peculiar, we were a family of sorts. And we sort of, we visualized that or we conceptualized that as you're not joining our family, we're creating a new family. And we conceptualized that when our next two children came in, it sounds awful. That we became a new family again when our children joined us. And then when the final one came, she does have a name.
It's a cult up there, isn't it?
It does sound like a cult. And then there was another. But we always saw that the joining of one changed everything. And we embraced that as opposed to always just grafting another child into the branch sort of thing, or into the whatever, the trunk. Mm.
Yeah,
that wasn't a question. It was a rubbish question, wasn't it?
That was common. And I think what I'd like
quickly moving on.
Yeah,
Scott, just
well, no,
on.
I'm just thinking of Jenny's given up a lot of time for this, but I'm just thinking about social workers as well, and you know what kind of summary can you give in terms of how social workers feel about this? Because social workers are human. Yeah. You know, some of them are parents, some of them are adoptive parents, and so what kind of things were they coming up with in terms of, you know, how they feel about the services that are offered compared to the services that they'd like to offer?
I guess would be my question. It's a great question, Scott. The fact that they were very ready to participate and to participate without any kind of defensiveness. I think it says a lot about their sense of wanting to know more and to then do the best they can once they've uncovered or been shown that maybe there are some areas that can be addressed and improved. And I've already done a couple of workshops with social workers, really paying them back for participating in the study. And they have all been really interested. Nobody has been defensive and said, oh, well, we can't do that because of this. Not at all. There's people are definitely I want to use the phrase leaning in, which I hate, but I don't know. That's why I want to say it. But they're kind of leaning in to kind of really engage with what might be happening for these families that is might be lacking in the way they're prepared. And I mean, they know, I think social workers that work in post-adoption support know that they're doing their best, but there's a long way to go to make it really good enough for everybody. In answer to your question, I think every single social worker I spoke to or who participated in any of the groups since then, and in fact, I was at Quorum today and I was talking to some social workers and they said, please come and tell us about this because we really want to know. So people, they want to know how much they're able to put something into practice is another question, but they're also interested in thinking about that. And I could do another podcast about patients policy practice. Not trying to get an invitation, by the way. I'm just
no, you're welcome back. You're fun.
Yeah, we normally wait a year, but yeah, you can come back next year. That's fine. That's absolutely fine.
Yeah, once you write your best practice guide, you can come.
Exactly, and that was going to be my final question to you. So obviously, this is still being signed off and all that sort of stuff. But when are people going to be able to read the results of this research, and where?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's a good
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe 2020.
Okay, so I am probably going to submit my thesis probably in the next couple of weeks or so. If Julie's listening to this, she'll be going, she's not quite there. So hopefully getting the thesis in. But with the way the process works at the Rees Centre, which is part of Oxford, you have to go through quite a lot of sort of academic testing to check that your thesis is rigorous and the methodology is rigorous and that you're being ethical and all those other things. So I've got through all of those and I'm just at the end of submitting my thesis. So the long answer to what should really be a very simply answered question is I'm not sure.
That's fair.
Fair point.
But fair point. I will say that for anybody who participated in the study, I am going to be sending something directly to them. Yeah. But I think probably by the middle of the summer, I should have some papers published because that's what you do. Mm. But also probably some things for maybe Adoption UK and don't know. As you can tell, I haven't really thought that through in great detail.
But you would hope that someone like Adoption England would pick this up in terms of...
Yeah, you're right, wouldn't you? Yeah.
Because they're this sort of the strategic and policy, I don't know, arm of the DfE in terms of adoption, that they would pick it up and kind of go, hey, let's get them, you know...
That's the thing. We need to look at it.
It's a thing. And if it's a third of people and if it's a... they've got the potential to capture the data to say, is this an increasing phenomena or a decreasing phenomena? And it feels like it's an important issue.
It's a really important issue. And I think the thing is that, we need people to come forward and adopt children. We absolutely do. And people need to be able to come and do that, feeling confident that they're going to be assessed and prepared to do that the best possible way and then to be supported afterwards. And it sounds very simple, doesn't it? But we know in practice that's quite hard to do. And, if there are additional things that these families need in advance, then that needs to be in place and all the way through, because we need families and these families can provide good homes. Unless I do the next piece of research and find out that actually for the adopted child and the birth child growing up in those families, they say it was actually really very difficult. Not that anyone was going to turn around and say that people with a birth child can't adopt. I don't think that will ever happen. I hope it won't.
I was looking at, and I would encourage people to go to the Facebook page and see if we can pin it to the top, because actually there's a few comments there of people who've done it and done it well, a lot of thought to it. And there's one comment by Michelle Royal and just really, just sort of saying this, we've put some thought into this and we've managed it well and it's working well. So so there is hope. And I think our experience, Scott, isn't there? That,
I think that our experiences could be slightly different, but
yeah,
I think there's a lot of similarities. And I think that, you know, reflection is a wonderful thing once you've lived it.
Yeah,
this is the thing, isn't it? You know, you kind of think, okay, well, I would have done that. And, you know, there is a lot of things that I would have done differently to make sure that all three of my children were, you know, kind of all looked after. I mean, they were all looked after. That's not, oh God, I don't want children's services on me in Ireland. But you know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, you want to expand, you want to extend your family, blah, blah, blah. And you want to do it for the right reasons, but actually sometimes it can, you know, it can have an impact, and you don't set out to do that, but sometimes it can have that kind of thing. And if you're not getting the right support, I guess, but we hear that every day, day in, day out, about the correct support. And that doesn't matter whether it's, you know, somebody who has a birth child and then adopts, or whether it's people who adopt, you know, that kind of thing. I guess all that I would like to think about is, you know, the fact that these families are going through whatever struggles they're going through, but actually I would just love to think that, you know, there was no difference in terms of whether it was a biological or adopted child, but I know that that's potentially not the case in a lot of cases. And that's mm-hmm. quite sad, because, you know, that the system isn't set up to kind of support that outcome, if that makes sense, which is very sad for me. That's waffly, but that's just how it is.
But taking that spot, sorry, I know you probably want to stop now, don't you? Because
no, if he's interested, he'll keep going, Jenny. If he's not,
it's nothing to do with me.
Right, we've done enough now. We've done 20 minutes, so we're gone.
Well, I'm just, honestly, it's your podcast, your guest, your podcast. I will stay like you do and be of neither use nor ornament like you are. Sorry, Jenny, you were saying.
I was just going to say that I am very reassured and hopeful from the response that I've had from social workers and from their participation in this, that they are keen and willing and energized to actually look at this in more detail. And we have to take that away from this. There's a little bit of a kind of, well, we didn't really know that this is what it was going to be like for them on the other side. And you're right, Scott, it's all sort of looking back, you know, over it from parents' point of view. It's like, well, you know, it would have been better if it had been done like this. But I think we have to look forward as well and say, you know, how can it be better? And that's what they're thinking too. That's what social workers think too. What can we do differently that will make it better? And I know that's probably no consolation for anybody who's struggling right now. Mm. But yeah, I think that's the thing I take away from it, is people want to do better if they possibly can.
Yeah, fab. As do we all. As do we all. We all want to do better, don't we? No, we do. We do.
You can do a lot better, Scott.
Oh, here we go. Here we go. Oh my days. It's been 5 years and she's still abusing me, honestly. No, I'm joking.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to say, Jenny Ginger, it's been a pleasure, but well, Jenny Ginger, it was a nice chat. See ya. No, it has been an absolute pleasure, and it's great to find out what you've been, you know, squirreled away doing this last couple of years, because, you know, I've no doubt with COVID and all that sort of stuff, it's been really hard. And I know that, you know, the preference is that you do these kinds of things for a PhD face to face and all that sort of stuff. So I'm no doubt you had to work your way around it. But thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And, you know, it just shows that sometimes when you email people, you know, you get in places. Yeah, I need to remember that, actually. I must be more like Jenny Ginger.
Yeah. There you go. Be more like Jenny Ginger. We should get t-shirts for that one. Be more like Jenny Ginger.
And there's an idea.
Yeah.
You'd like a bit of merch. We could sell them on the website, couldn't we?
Yeah. Friend of the show, be more like Jenny Ginger. Exactly. We've got a range going.
Yeah. But in all seriousness, next year, same time, as in, you know, once this is out and you're getting feedback.
Yeah,
and stuff,
get in touch.
Do come back and join us, and we can chat about it. Yeah.
We could do a live and people could ask questions. That would be great.
Oh, yeah.
Good. Well, thank you very much for giving me all of this time.
You're welcome.
You're great guys to talk to.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'd like to apologise because my wife's still not back from Australia.
Is she coming back? Is she coming back?
No, she's not. She's enjoying herself too much. I've messaged her. She's extending by a week. It's hilarious. Honestly, I'm loving it. I'm loving it.
I've got no words. Yeah.
Anyway. I actually, for a change, listened to last week's episode because apparently it was really good.
Really?
And I did listen to it, and I did chuckle to myself when you were trying to explain yourself away and how many times I was like, Al, that is just parenting. That's just being an adult. You know, you've had it so easy for so long, mate.
I took the 12-year-old shopping. Sorry, Jenny. I took a 12-year-old shopping. It's madness.
No, you should never do that. Why did you do that? You go in, you go on your own, and you do what you need to do, and you get out.
She had the great time. We've spent a fortune on
things. Jenny's horrified. She's going, do you? No, you don't do that.
No, that'll not happen again. I'll not take her again. Honestly.
It's a learning thing, isn't it, being a parent? It's just constant learning.
Yeah. You would have thought 25 years in, I would have really got the message by now, but I'm just, there's so many new experiences. And I haven't really understood the whole dark wash, whitewash thing.
Oh,
I'm not really
no.
sure what's going on there.
Oh, really? Oh, my days.
And so I sort of thought, I was a little bit cynical about that because I thought, really? It's 2024. So, but I don't care because I'm colorblind.
Okay, I'm going to ring Paula now, I think, and just give her some information about this. Oh my God. Do you know what? Like, Tris isn't colorblind, but he's of the same kind of thing. He just goes, oh no, I just chucked it all in. And I'm like, what about the whites? Oh, what? Well, they're only a bit gray. No, you. Oh. I need to, no, I can't. Wait,
anyway,
I can't talk to you. I can't talk to you about this anymore. Thank you. Oh, Bon Jovi.
Anchovy.